Well, welcome to Just Around the Corner. I'm your host, Dennis Mansfield, and today we're launching into a different type of podcast in that for the last 2 years, we've had many, many episodes that we've done with audio. But today, as is obvious, we've gone to the video opportunity, and we will have half of this year's podcast done in video and the other, of course, in audio. So with that in mind, I asked the folks that I have the honor of working with, what would be the best way that we could launch this opportunity? And first off was my bride. She said, you got to have Stuart McLaren on. And Susan and Stuart and I have known each other for many years. And the official bio is a wonderful bio. Stuart is the president of the White House Historical Association. He's also been involved in many, many top-level executive positions, both as the administrator and early on in his career as the executive assistant to whoever it might have been, the president, the dean, whatever the particular organization that he was in. But about 9+ years ago, Stuart was asked to come aboard for the White House Historical Association. So with that, we thought we would launch at the best place possible, and that's with my good friend Stuart McLaren. Stuart, welcome to Just Around the Corner.
Well, Dennis, it's good to be with you and to go down memory lane a little bit. Those many years ago when we first crossed paths, we were a different world, different lifetime ago, but we've enjoyed a friendship over the decades and am so grateful to have this opportunity with you and to be a part of your podcast.
Well, thank you. Stuart, the White House Historical Association, could you give us an overview of what it is and when it started?
Well, we were founded in 1961 by First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy, who had visited the White House as a teenager with her mother and had come to the White House with President Kennedy. Remember, she's 31 years old when she becomes First Lady, and she had every reason to believe that her husband would be president for 4 years or for 8 years. But she was so passionate about making the White House a museum standard. You see, before the Kennedys, a new president could come into the White House and get rid of anything they wanted to. And they wanted newer things rather than what we would appreciate today as an antique or Americana. Mrs. Kennedy thought it should have the very best of American craftsmen and artisans and artists. And so she set about doing that. And without spending government money to do so, she created this private entity, the White House Historical Association, to maintain this museum standard of the interiors of the White House with non-taxpayer funding. And that's how we started and began. And we have continued through 12 presidencies now. And our role is the same, regardless who the president and first lady may be. But it's all thanks to Mrs. Kennedy's early vision and even beyond her vision, her action to put this into place. Dennis, I don't think it's something we could create today. I think whoever was out of the White House would say, oh, you're doing this for your own benefit, your own favor, not for the country. But yeah, she did it at a time when it could be established as nonpartisan and be a valid nonprofit organization. And that solidified and has continued all these years.
Stuart, when you get on the elevator and somebody finds out about your work, what is that elevator pitch that you give to them about the mission of the White House Historical Association?
Well, you know, we have to get over the hurdle of, well, isn't that something the government should do? Why doesn't the government take care of the house? Well, the government for sure takes care of the infrastructure, the electricity, the plumbing, the building itself. But can you imagine having to go to a congressman or a senator for funding, or they would come to you wanting an artist from their state or district to be in the White House? So my quick and simple pitch is similar to what I said in this opening, that the country is very fortunate to have had a first lady who had the vision to supply a structure and a framework that every president and first lady could benefit from to take care of the White House. But more than that, she envisioned an education mission to teach and to tell the stories about the White House and its history. And that's another part of what we do.
Stuart, do you think that because it was begun in that vein, that sense, that the that the First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy, who brought such class and such decorum to the White House, I mean, to the administration, to politics, to Washington, D.C., and obviously, therefore, to the White House. Do you think that because of that, you are still able to avoid the potential conflict that happens in a political town of political towns, Washington, D.C., as you move forward into the future? Has that been a great help to you in moving towards and out of the political realm?
Well, I think, Dennis, what's a great help is she did this over 60 years ago. And we have this proven track record now of working quietly and effectively with presidencies of all parties and all ideologies. And when you get into what represents the very best of our country in terms of furnishings, fine arts, decorative arts, rugs, draperies, these are not political questions or policy questions. These are matters of design and matters of depicting these artisans of our country. And as you walk through the house, it is one of the most amazing, incredible art collections in the world of all American artists. We've had first ladies over the course of time and presidents who have added African-American artists. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Trump added the first Asian-American work of art to the White House collection. And so over the course of time, we do evolve what is in the collection, and the first ladies and presidents contribute to that and make that happen. But we're very, very fortunate that we have this tradition and this custom in place that has now gone through all of these presidencies, and I don't see that it will have any problem continuing to do so.
You know, Stuart, as the president of the White House Historical Association, do you ever, when you're walking to work, you've parked your car, and you're walking to work, and you're crossing Pennsylvania Avenue, let's say, do you ever just stop and pinch yourself that you're actually there at the White House and have been for almost a decade?
Well, I do marvel at that no matter how many times you go into the White House. To me, I each time have that same awe and reverence of the place, the space, all those who have gone before, the people who have contributed to the tapestry that makes our country the great and wonderful country that it is. And it's certainly not anything that I take for granted when I go there. And I'm grateful for every day to have the opportunity and the privilege to do what we do on behalf of the American people.
Well, I remember one time, and it might have been when one of the first times that the president, former presidents of the United States had gotten together for a photo op, and I believe it was during, may have been during President Reagan's administration. And I don't know whether it was David Kennerly, one of the White House, the White House photographer under President Ford or not, but he was in attendance. And he said it was like being in a living Mount Rushmore. and I wondered, for you, you've been there now almost 10 years. You've met probably, well, you've met all of the presidents since that time, but you in the past had met presidents or former presidents. Right. Of those, who do you remember having the greatest time with? They're all great men, don't get me wrong, but some had a particular touch of your heart. Of course, Ronald Reagan comes to mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned President Reagan. That's who was president when I first moved to Washington, and my first role in Washington was aligned with that presidency. And yet I've had opportunities to be exposed to all presidents since, and each has was elected, except for President Ford, of course, who preceded Reagan. And each has something that they have contributed to our country in their own way. Many of them, if not all of them, had severe challenges of some kind during their presidency that really was a struggle or a difficulty related to them or those in their cabinet or in their administration. And so it's not, you're not talking about perfect system of government. You're certainly not talking about perfect men and women in these roles, but you're talking about a continuity of government and a continuity of leadership that is changed and taken on different shapes and visions over the course of our history. And the one thing that relates to what we do that is special, as different as all of these men who've been president, as different as they've been, they really have one thing in common. And that is the fact that they lived and worked in that building that we call the White House. Mm. Now, George Washington is the only one who didn't. He selected the site and hired the architect and oversaw the building. But all the others, that's the stage, that's the platform, that's the place from which they lived and governed and led our country through war, through depression, through crises, through self-made crises in many cases. Yeah. But we've come through on the other end, and our country has evolved to always be better and stronger despite the challenges. And the thing that is wonderful about what we do is we're sort of the stage managers of this constantly changing play called the American government. And the stage of the White House is consistent and constant and always there, and we're taking care of it to make sure it is maintained for the American people, and it is better and better and better regardless of what happens in the world or with a particular presidency.
Stuart, you make mention the fact that it's the executive mansion. It's where the president works, where he lives, where his children, if his children were young enough to be able to grow up. Do you have any particular stories about some of the first sons and first daughters of different presidents there at the White House?
Sure. Well, those watching and listening to your podcast will remember many presidential children. Of course, Caroline and John Kennedy come to mind with the assassination of their father and those very poignant pictures of them as very young children. We've had some rambunctious presidential children. The children of Teddy Roosevelt are a prime example of that. That's back when the president's office and the family were all on the same floor at the White House, as well as the Roosevelt children and all of their animals. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Roosevelt finally said, enough of this. And that's when the president's offices were moved out, and what became the West Wing today was built, and that now houses the senior-most staff of the president of the United States. But we do, just as we continue to work with living former presidents and first ladies, I have interaction quite frequently with the adult children of our former presidents and first ladies. I think of Lyndon Johnson Robb and Lucy Johnson, the daughters of President and Mrs. Johnson, we see and work with frequently, really wonderful people. Susan Ford, I was with just 2 weeks ago. This year, our White House Christmas ornament features the Ford presidency, and Susan and I went down to Norfolk to the USS Gerald R. Ford and did a presentation to the commanding officer and the crew there. And Susan is really fantastic, of course, also her brothers. Mm-hmm. And Trisha Nixon, I saw Trisha recently. She is really terrific. And there's so many of them. The next generation of George H.W. Bush, we had a president in that generation, but the grandchildren to President George H.W. Bush are really terrific and have been involved. Many of them have been involved in what we're doing as well. So Republicans, Democrats, they have wonderful stories of either growing up as high school students in the White House. Susan Ford had her high school prom at the White House.
I remember reading about that.
Story of that. Yeah. They all talk about reminiscing about the protests they hear from their bedroom windows on the north side of the White House, and whether it was the Vietnam War or some other cause or event that protesters were out there, they can be heard. And the president does hear those voices of the American people out there. But to hear the reminiscences and the reflections of these presidential children and grandchildren is really, really wonderful. And I don't think they fully appreciate the experience until much later in life when those become wonderful memories.
Well, I remember the quote that Teddy Roosevelt was has been attributed to him, when they talked about Alice, his firstborn, being so rebellious and smoking on top of the White House and doing all of these things. And his quote, of course, as you all know, because you've probably used it many times, but it's, look, I can either run the country or I can manage my daughter Alice, but I cannot do both.
Well, Alice, you're exactly right. That is a famous quote of President Roosevelt's, and she was quite a character, even into adulthood. She was quite a force and a presence here in Washington.
Yeah, I'd like to take us back to a point you made earlier about George Washington. He was able to secure the land upon which the White House was built and to start the process, finding the architect. Would you walk us through the idea of a sitting president of the United States negotiating with landowners in and around what's now, of course, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue?
Sure.
And then how did he find the architect from Ireland?
Well, that's about a day's worth of conversation right there, Dennis.
Give us your best shot.
I'll give you the short version. It was in 1790. The Congress and the president were governing in Philadelphia at the time. The Congress passed the Residence Act, which gave the president 10 years from 1790 to 1800 to create a home for the president and a meeting place for the Congress in this new federal city, which was right in the sort of the middle of the country, toward the south, but in the middle of the country, where 10 square miles would be taken from the state of Virginia and the state of Maryland, and that would comprise the new federal city. And so the clock began ticking on how to accomplish this. And so L'Enfant was brought in to design the city. You're exactly right. Negotiations had to be had with the farmers. This was farmland that existed here in what is now Washington, D.C. And it was sort of a early act of eminent domain, I guess, where the government came in and said, we're taking these 10 square miles. This is going to be the federal city. The government will operate here. Georgetown existed, and there were little towns nearby that operated, but it was really an entire new city from land that was right here on the banks of the Potomac. And how the White House building came about was Washington in 1791 undertook a southern tour of the United States from Philadelphia down through Maryland and North Carolina and into South Carolina. And he spent about 5 days in Charleston, South Carolina, where he was introduced to a young Irish-born builder there by the name of James Hoban. And he saw buildings in Charleston that Hoban would have been a part of, the courthouse and others. These were large stone structures. And it was a year later in Philadelphia, as Washington was really honing in on who could do this work? Who did he have trust and confidence in? It was actually a competition to select the builder, but I happen to think that Washington had his thumb on the scale. He knew the type of builder he wanted, someone that he could have confidence and trust in to build the type of house that he wanted. And that was a great stone house, like the stone houses of the country manor houses of Ireland. Stone was used in limited ways in America at that time, but most of the houses were brick or wooden. And Washington believed that a great stone house would be respected in the capitals of Europe. Mm-hmm. And he knew that a builder like he had met in Charleston in James Hoban would have that experience. And so he brought Hoban to Philadelphia. They eventually led to him being selected as the builder, and Hoban put together an assembly of workers that included artisans from Europe, which were the 8 Scottish stonemasons who came over, also from Ireland. There were enslaved workers. We've identified right at 200 enslaved people who worked to build the White House right outside my window here in what is now Lafayette Park. Free workers. All of these workers were in this community of life right here in front of where the White House now stands. And we do our best to physically tell their stories out in Lafayette Park and through our books and our publications and our online programming and our in-person programming to tell these stories about these people whose blood, sweat, toil built this house, and whose names and memories would be long gone unless we were there to tell their story. One last point about James Hoban, which I marvel at. Here's a man, he comes to America. He was Roman Catholic. He had really hit the ceiling of where he could advance due to the penal laws in Ireland. So he comes to America. He would not say this, but I happen to believe it was an early adapter of pursuing the American dream. Mm-hmm. And he comes to America. He ends up in Charleston, where he is met by George Washington. And then in 1792, the cornerstone is laid. Then he works to build the White House up until 1800 when John and Abigail Adams move in. House is not finished, so it continues to be worked on. The British burn the White House in 1814. Mm-hmm. Takes 3 years to rebuild. Hoban is deeply engaged in that work. Then with President James Monroe, following that, he works to add the South Portico, the rounded portico. Mm-hmm. And then with Thomas Jefferson, or excuse me, Andrew Jackson, he builds the North Portico. So from 1792, when the cornerstone is laid, until when he dies in 1831, wow. This man, this Irish-born immigrant builder, spends all the virtually his entire career, adult life, working on this building. And so few people know that name, James Hoban, but around the world, his life's work is known by three words, the White House.
Yes.
And I think that is really, really compelling.
Stuart, I remember when you wrote and then published the life of James Hoban, and you did a tremendous job, but a tremendous blessing to the nation by bringing his memory up. And so much so that when Susan and I started our plans for our next adventure, which would soon be a trip to Ireland, to Dublin, we wanted to see what he saw that birthed yes. his creativity into making the White House what it was. And one of the things, and help me with the pronunciation, it's the Leinster House, is that correct?
Yeah, Leinster House it was a former country house in Dublin, but is now the seat of the Irish Parliament. And when you walk up to the facade of that, you will see really the bones of the White House, the design that Hoban had in his mind's eye. Mm-hmm. And of course, we all take things we're familiar with and that we've sure. had in our past forward with us in our career. And you'll see, Dennis, that the bones of that building are exactly reminiscent of the White House that we have today.
I am amazed at the impact that this one architect, this one builder, as you earlier said, created not just a residence, but an example for people all over the world of freedom. It's embodied in,
right.
It's not just the White House, it's our White House.
That's right.
And so with that, you know, it makes me smile. I am, as you well know, a lover of history. And one of the gentlemen that I so admire is John Hay, one of the two assistants to Abraham Lincoln, his private secretaries, who lived in the White House with John Nicolay. And I forget which room what it would be equivalent to now, but it was an area where two young men could reside and work with with truly one of the world's greatest citizens, Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
And one of the things that Lincoln would do is if he was unable to get to sleep, he'd walk around in his, you know, pajamas or whatever they had in the 1860s, probably the long sleeping gown, and go in with the private secretaries and sit and tell jokes and stories and warm-hearted, encouraging things. John Hay ended up becoming Secretary of State under two presidents. There were three moments in his life where he almost became president because the vice president was absent and the president himself was injured. And at that time, Secretary of State would move up. The thing that reminds me as I read through John Hay's life It's one of the reasons why we call our podcast Just Around the Corner, because he said that truly all the greatest things in life, though they might not be right with us, they were in fact just around the corner. And so, so as I think about that in a very clear way, certainly in a nonprofit way, you have filled his shoes in touching people, encouraging people, speaking out about the beauty of the White House and the beauty of our government in a way that that John Hay thoroughly would have done in his time and certainly did, but also from the ghosts of long gone. There's no doubt in my mind that he's nodding in approval, Stuart, to the work that you personally have done. So as we come in for landing, what makes you smile each morning as you get up and and go, I'm going to the White House Historical Association again? Sure. What makes you smile?
That's a great question. One of the things that I enjoy most about my job is, even though we are an education organization and we do so much to teach and to tell these stories like we've discussed today, I learn something new every single day. I could work in this role the rest of my career and never learn all there is to know. And that's a wonderful thing to keep it alive and fresh for me. And I never know what that's going to be on any given day, but either through some research or a conversation or a meeting I have, something bubbles up that is interesting and new to me. And that makes me smile too. There's no 2 days that are the same. We're always involved in different projects and activities. Met just yesterday with the First Lady in our regular meeting, and Dr. Biden is really terrific. She has wonderful ideas, a great keen sense of history, and education is her passion, which melds well with what we do.
Sure.
But that's not unlike the work that we also did with Mrs. Trump and with Mrs. Obama. I came in 1914, it feels like it, 2014. I came in 2014, and I've had the privilege of working closely and successfully with the Obamas and the Trumps and the Bidens. And that's the way it should be.
Yes.
That shouldn't be an unusual thing.
Yes.
But in our day and age, that is unusual. But I can say that that's the way we work, and that's what we do, and that's the way it should be.
Well, I can tell you this, that over the last 40 plus years that we've had the honor as friends to watch one another's careers grow, to see my children all consider you really a Dutch uncle to them, because you've always been a part of their lives. In fact, there are many stories that we won't take the valuable time to talk about, but you had an influence on Nate. You had an influence on Maggie, you still do, and her children. And Colin going off to the White House to be able to hear from you that you had selected him when he was going into his plebe year to be on the Ronald Reagan committee. Tremendous things. As a plebe, he got to speak to President Reagan's the audience that attended it. The funny thing, and I don't think I've ever shared this with you, he said, Dad, you know, I came on the stage right before the Beach Boys came on, because they were, of course, President Reagan's, one of his favorite bands.
Right.
So when they found out, they could tell he was in a West Point cadet uniform. All of them, from Mike Love on, were like peppering him with questions about what's it like to be. And he's sitting there thinking, I'm with the Beach Boys and they're asking me about my life. But that's the kind of community,
right,
from different parts that you've successfully cobbled together so that our nation never looks up to somebody because they're some sort of icon, but instead looks at one another because we're fellow Americans. Now I would argue, Stuart, you would probably think that as a graduate of the University of Alabama, that that your football team is a representative of that great fabric of America, you'd probably argue that because you are a Bama boy, did I get that right? not only is the team great, the school is good, the state of Alabama is wonderful, but that you might just be able in the future at some point to have your football team play our small but powerful Boise State Broncos.
That's the bluegrass team, isn't it?
That's correct. Yes, and they're potato fed, and they're really ready for Bama. So as we come in, Stuart, I just want to tell you thanks. Thanks for your sense of humor, your laughter. Thanks for your service, for the many years that you've served already, and the many more that you will serve. You know, our family and many, many more families are thankful for that. Any final comments you'd like to make?
Well, I too want to thank you for the friendship that you and Sue have had with me over the years, and what that has meant to me, and your wonderful family of three kids that I've had the privilege of knowing from the tiniest of tiny, and see the evolution of them, and with Colin and Meg and the kids that they have today, and the generations of that your family that are continuing to evolve. And thank you for your leadership and your the lessons that you convey through your own life and through your message and through your words and through your faith to those that you encounter every single day. And I think that we can all look back on the lives that we have touched and that we've been touched by. And you and Sue have certainly impacted mine. I recall back when I was in the high school, I was given a poster, I guess in the earlier form of a tweet. We didn't have tweets then, so we had posters on our wall with pithy sayings. And I was given one that says, "We are all molded and remolded by those who have loved us. No one can cross the path of our destiny without leaving some mark upon it forever." And you and Sue crossed my path a long, long time ago in Southern California and left a significant mark on my life that I'm very grateful for. And having the opportunity to have this conversation with you today, you and I never dreamed we'd be able to be talking about such things, but here we are, and just blessed by God to have had the roles and responsibilities that we've had and the friendship we've had, which I'm very grateful for.
Thank you, Stuart. Ladies and gentlemen, Stuart McLaurin, the president of the White House Historical Association. If you'd like to know more, I'd like you to visit DennisMansfield.com and then click on to subscribe to our newsletter. We'll be posting some great thoughts about the White House, some links that will come about as a result of today's video interview. And then, Stuart, there's only one thing I can say, baby. Roll Tide.
Thank you, Dennis. I'll take it.
All right. Take care. God bless.
Bye-bye.